This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Purple Mountain Majesty of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
I just can't believe all the things people say. Controversy. Am I black or white? Am I straight?
And you are hearing Controversy by Prince Rogers Nelson, one of the songs that neatly summarized who he was and what he was about. Prince died yesterday at the age of 57, and we're here today with several writers from the New York Times: John Caramonica, music critic; John Pareles, music critic; Wesley Morris, critic at large. Let's talk a little bit about our response, our first feelings, yep, and maybe what we did yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the news obviously first came via TMZ, and I really had a flashback to Michael Jackson's passing because TMZ had reported that and was very early on the reports of Michael Jackson's death. And especially there were maybe an hour, hour and a half at that time where other outlets were reporting that he had not died. Mm-hmm. But TMZ was like, no, this is what's happening. And so when this happened and I saw it was TMZ reporting, I felt sort of that immediate gut punch. Yeah. I had someone ask me yesterday if I doubted it because it was on TMZ. And I was like, no, that's how I knew.
No, that's how you know.
That's
now
how I knew it was real. Mm-hmm. You know, there had been some skepticism because of the last couple of weeks. There's been strange things happening with Prince.
Right.
He canceled a couple shows. He had a flight, a chartered plane that he was on, taking an emergency landing, and he was rushed to a hospital and then left the hospital. And they're like very suspicious circumstances.
Yeah.
So something's been in the air and no one's really talking about it. And I think maybe we were just beginning to sniff around it to see what was up.
I mean, he played in Atlanta, was it last week?
Yeah, sometime within 5 days, I think.
A couple shows in Atlanta, just voice and piano. They were real expensive shows, and some people complained that he did not play long enough. But I mean, it was over an hour. Nobody thought anything was wrong. He sang great.
No, and the publicist said it was the flu.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
I know, you know, we were working yesterday, but other than that, emotionally, well, how did we get through it?
My first response was, he's not dead. He
right.
was so alive. He was alive every second you ever saw him. I mean, he was like a fireball. He was a spark plug. He was always completely vital. There was so much life force in that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I get the text, Prince is dead, and I think immediately, this can't be true. This has to be a hoax. And then 5 minutes later, I think, oh, wow, I have to write an obit in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my day.
Wesley?
I don't even think it's real. Like, I haven't slept. I have not had a chance to dream about this. I did fall asleep at 6 o'clock for about 40 minutes.
Me too.
And I had a really intense dream about a dog.
Really?
So maybe tonight will be my Prince dream.
Yeah.
I got the text last week from somebody who was like, you know, if this happens, you and I are going to have a moral duty to respond to this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, then it can't happen because I can't do that right now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I also just, like everybody else, didn't want it to be true.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any, it didn't make any sense because of all the people to have this happen to, in an absolute sense. Michael Jackson, mm-hmm. not a shocking, mm-hmm. but not shocking right. at the same time. This is 100% shocking to me in the sense that, like, there was no Prince Death Watch.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, like, Prince was sort of persistently shrouded in mystique and secrecy.
Yes.
So if there was something that was going on with Prince in some kind of ongoing, sustained way, we wouldn't have known. Whereas all of Michael Jackson's traumas were
public,
tabloid fodder.
Right. Yes.
And Prince led a very unusual and specific life and a very cloistered life. So it's completely... It feels completely plausible that there was something happening that was walled off to the rest of the world.
But he was athletic. He was working. He was touring. He wasn't hidden away in the Citadel. He was on the road.
Mm-hmm. I just saw him a month ago.
He
seemed fine.
You mean performing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the book release party.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it wasn't a show. Like, I would, if I had paid for that, I would have been upset. But no, I wouldn't if it was Prince. You know, he came. He did about 4 songs.
Yeah.
He left for about what must have been 2.5 or 3 hours, came back, and pretty much did the same thing over again at a keyboard in a corner with no lights, no cell phones allowed, nothing. And it was still pretty special. He did not mingle with even the selected hoi polloi. Mm. That were gathered at his feet, basically. But he seemed fine to me, which is why this is also shocking. What about you? Where were you?
Well, I was at home. My overriding feeling was, I'm not ready for this,
right.
Which I realized later is how I felt about lots of things that, mm-hmm. that Prince did. You know, like I don't have the vocabulary for this. I can't quite process this. And I felt upset and kind of sick, actually,
mm-hmm.
until later. One of the only places you can hear Prince for free now is on terrestrial radio. I listened to WBLS in the afternoon and felt a lot better.
Sure.
You know? John Pareles wrote a great obituary.
Thanks.
On a crazy schedule. Definitely. Definitely. Compiling and condensing his life and accomplishments. John Caramonica, you wrote an essay specifically about Prince and technology. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
You call him a hacker.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
It struck me that, I mean, modern day Prince is often painted as this kind of Luddite figure who, like, hates YouTube and hates the internet and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But
suspicious
Prince,
of it.
Right.
Well, litigious, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, more than suspicious. But in the 90s, he was one of the first true pop stars really aggressively pushing internet stuff forward. You know, he put out a CD-ROM with, like, an interactive game. He sold Crystal Ball. He sold Crystal Ball on, like, a single-serving website, designed just to sell this one album.
Yeah.
Though people did get it months late.
Well, that's true. There was some issue in my piece about whether it's 1997 or 1998. It was offered for sale in 1 year.
Might have been because it was too heavy to deliver.
That's true. Well, you know, it's a workout tool.
Yes,
it could have sounded with an exercise DVD as well. And, he had NPG Music Club, which is, you know, basically like a one-man Netflix situation for Prince music in the early 2000s. So he had all this sort of open-minded approaches that easily predate what the traditional record business was doing mm-hmm. by 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point in like the mid-2000s, he just was like, poof, shut off,
mm-hmm.
started pulling things off YouTube, completely removed himself.
He made the statement, the internet is over.
In 2010.
Which was widely misunderstood.
2010, he said the internet's, it was mostly over or mainly over.
Or something like that.
What he was really saying is that iTunes and YouTube and sites and outlets like that had so cornered the marketplace that artists were continuing to suffer. And I think in his mind, he was likening the internet of the early 2000s, of the early 2010s, to major labels in the 80s or major labels in the 90s. In my mind, and I talk about this in the piece a little bit, his rejection of kind of what we are thinking of as peak internet. Like, oh, it's just getting better. Spotify is getting better. And, like, streaming is getting better. And there's more stuff on YouTube. I think for Prince, there was something still unsatisfying about how this had all played out. Mm-hmm. And in his mind, there was some kind of like utopian technology that either hadn't yet to be invented or had not been refined to the point where it was good enough for prints. Mm-hmm. And I sort of deeply believe if there had been some genius programmer, code writer, whatever, who had developed a better YouTube or a better whatever, Prince would have been like, cool, mm-hmm. I'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know. Like, well, Tidal, I mean, I don't know how. I mean,
don't you dare say Tidal.
I mean, that's where the music is. That's yes. where everybody had to go yesterday if you wanted to listen to it and you didn't already own it. If you weren't John Perellis
I literally
and
can't,
had all your vinyl.
I can't believe I just said a better YouTube and you said Tidal.
Well, I didn't mean it that way.
Okay.
So,
just checking.
But I'm saying that that's where the music is living right now, right? So, for instance, there's this woman named April who works at the coffee shop I go to every day. Mm. And I've been trying to get her to listen to Sign of the Times for like 4 months. And she's like, yeah.
She's never heard it?
Never heard it.
Wow.
Never heard any songs from it. She's young.
Sure.
She's like 21.
Sure, sure.
So I'm like, I just want to be near you when yeah. I'm going to bring my phone in one day. We're going to take the store's phone out.
Yeah.
Because you're on Spotify.
Yeah.
We're going to put my phone in. We're going to mm-hmm. use Tidal.
Mm-hmm.
You got, that, you got that high fidelity $19.99 package, or you got just the $9.99?
Okay, I'm not gonna. You don't make me sit here and defend Tidal. I'm not gonna do it. It is a vehicle for music. Period. Mm-hmm. I don't like it either, but
like
it's all I have.
It's like a Geo Metro for music. Yeah.
That's your judgment. For me, it is like it is the only street I can use.
It's
to
value
get to
neutral.
The other street.
Okay, it's value neutral.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe what you're getting at is that there's a lot of people out there who have not heard a lot of great Prince music.
Well, can we talk about one aspect of him that I find fascinating to answer your question? I feel like at some point his Warner Brothers situation and the rancorousness of what went down between him and the label, because, you know, up to that point, he was making albums like coherent, sort of unified albums in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And after, like, once the Warner Brothers thing heated up, right around the time of the Love Symbol album,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the albums, like, there was always two songs too many, three songs too many, 48 songs too many.
Mm.
He was so prolific and wanted to do so many things that the album, he started to transcend the album.
Yeah.
And then that way, he's also weirdly ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this is a sort of separate conversation or a separate question, but I wonder if we're now so far from album appreciation
yeah.
that for this woman, April, to really appreciate Sign of the Times, for instance, like she can appreciate it, but like the albumness of it,
sure.
she might not get to all 16 songs.
Mm-hmm. She might not even have the framework to understand why that at that time was meaningful.
I wonder.
Talking about his moment of switching over from Tight albums into Overspill, John Perellis, you went out to Minnesota to interview Prince in Minnesota at the time that he released Emancipation,
right,
the triple CD record. And you talked with him about that issue in particular, the fact that so much inspiration comes to him, he can deal with it so quickly. What are you going to do with that?
No, I mean, you do have the feeling that he was just this channel for music. Mm-hmm. I mean, you did have the feeling that every waking moment, if he could be, he would be making music if he wasn't having sex. But mostly making music.
Or at the same time. I mean,
I remember that day in Chanhassen because this was the most energetic person I'd ever seen. He was enthusiastic. He was making mystical and numerological connections. He was.
You mean as you spoke?
This was when he was married.
Yeah.
And he compared.
The Maite years.
Yeah, the Maite years. And he compared her mother's name, Janelle, to his father's name, John L.
Yeah.
He was free associative, mm-hmm. but he was also, he had business plans. He could see if there was a problem with somebody's costume for the stage. He was like Mr. Detail,
yeah.
but he was just completely alert to everything. Mm. I'd actually been out there before. He had showed me at that time the costume room, which was full of all these, mm-hmm. you know, shall we say revealing, shall we say glittery, shall we say brightly colored. And then he took me back to the same room, and now it was the Bible study room.
Uh-huh.
In Paisley uh-huh. Park. Mm. But he remembered, you know, my previous visit years earlier and which rooms he'd taken mm-hmm. me to. Mm-hmm. His random access memory was a lot bigger than mine.
But I remember a line maybe at the very end of that piece where, you know, you were getting down to the issue of selectiveness concision
right.
versus never turning off the tap, you know? Right. And he said to you something like, if you could do this, you know, like if yeah. you had the songs flowing out of your mind
all
the
time
just
do it?
And put them on tape in your own place, wouldn't you do it?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, you know, after I was ushered out by his
politely whatever. Ushered out because your time was up.
My time was up.
Home,
but then I'm walking by one of the little just studios and I hear somebody drumming. And I had the feeling it was him making another song. Get that guy out. I got a song in me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, it was mind-blowing to be there.
And to pick up on that idea about the tap and the songs are flowing and to touch on what you were saying just before, I mean, Prince's post-1996 output is really like the SoundCloud era before the SoundCloud. It's the mixtape era before mixtape. You know,
That is 100% true.
It's like, you know what I have is I have four 20-minute sketches, and, like, that's a thing.
Uh-huh.
You know what I have is a bunch of, like, small farts, and, like, that's a thing.
Yep.
And it's just, like, constantly, like, there's no – we didn't have all this. You look at this pile of albums that we have, you know, 1978 to 1991, this essential Prince stuff, this we didn't have. I mean, that's what frustrated, I think, people like myself. It's like, if you're raised on
because
this.
Because you were spoiled with this.
Yeah, if you're raised on this, and then all of a sudden you're confronted with, like, the weird jazz.
400 songs.
Yeah, or like the weird jazz album that comes only with certain copies of Crystal Ball, and you're just like, what?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And that's sort of what, for me, I think began to ruin the ability to appreciate even something like the Love Symbol album, which I think, I listened to it last night.
Mm-hmm.
It's Three Chains of Gold and The Sacrifice of Victor. That is pretty much like a tombstone on this record,
uh-huh.
or those two songs mm-hmm. are. But the other, like, 12 songs or 13 mm-hmm. songs are, like, as an album, really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he just was beginning to get to the place of excess. And I think after that, was Emancipation after that? There might have been maybe...
Yeah, Emancipation was...
Yeah, Emancipation was definitely...
Well, the other problem was he was fighting with Warner Brothers. He was just dumping stuff.
Right.
And that's a good way to lose your audience, too, is to like, not exercise the quality control.
It was Chaos and Disorder that's after that.
Yeah.
A shorter album, underrated, not great, but, mm-hmm. like, Dinner with Dolores, great song.
Mm-hmm.
Chaos and Disorder, the song is mm-hmm. really good. Anyway.
Well, that's the thing. Even in the Avalanche, he was still a great musician.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and it was just too much for our... 45-minute, 77-minute CD minds to absorb.
Wesley, you wrote an essay about Prince and sex.
I did.
What's that all about?
He was sexy.
Yeah.
But not only that, he just was... He confused a lot of things.
Yeah.
And that confusion was really interesting because it was never a problem for him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He wasn't like... I was trying to think of other people who were like this in pop, and there aren't that many. Cyndi Lauper, who is a much less... She's not in this class of artist.
Yeah.
But she never really changed, right? She had a look, and she didn't really deviate too far from that.
Yeah.
And she had a sound that she didn't really deviate too far from. I mean, Prince was a deviator, but it all sort of cohered. But he looked the same now. It looked the same when he died as he did in 1979 or 1980, or 1982.
Yeah.
He was really good with himself. He didn't have all of the hang-ups and issues, and he didn't appear to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his music wasn't a psychological journey. He wasn't mm-hmm. being, until Emancipation, he wasn't being persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
He was exploring himself, and every once in a while, exploring society. The thing that was great about Prince to me was he wasn't, like, bringing his problems to us.
Uh-huh.
A little bit on Purple Rain, but, like, there are a lot of things that happen on that record and in that movie that didn't happen again, I think, for the better. But I think his consistency is what sort of made him fascinating. It's like sort of persona consistency.
Yeah.
From that, I think people were able to, like, attach things to that.
Yeah.
Because it was fixed. And he was clearly sexual.
Yeah.
And if you were a person who responded to sexuality, then you couldn't deny what he was giving you because he always gave it. And the sex part never changed.
One of the binaries that he transcended and sort of made redundant was sex and love. And I feel for you. He's got that line, I wouldn't lie to you, baby. This is mainly a physical thing.
Mm.
But then he says, I think I love you. You know, like for him, sex was a lot and it might be enough.
A lot of his songs end with, oh, wait, we just had sex, but I also think I love you. Raspberry Beret, same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, but ecstatic. Like, I think, but he's not sure.
Right.
There's a lot of not being sure in his song. Like, I guess, I think, maybe.
Mm.
I don't know what that's about, but he's never sure about the love part.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this is getting into, like, is it really him or is it a persona?
Is
he trying to say something just relatable, you know, that we can understand,
but I
that
think is
mortal
weird,
beings
right?
can understand?
Like, I mean, all right.
But also it's about being in the moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're in that post-sexual ecstasy. You do think you love the person.
You do.
I mean, yeah. And he was also in the moment on stage all the time. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, I'm going to jam now. I'm going to do this dance. You follow me, band.
Yeah.
He was about being right in that moment. And
yeah.
Part of the reason you got the avalanche of music when he could just decide what he wanted to do, when he turned into SoundCloud, is because that was the moment, I'm going to put it out.
Yeah.
You know, there was not that sense you got in the album studio era that you had a limited time frame and a limited format. There was like, I can just stretch the moment forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very sexual thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was all also like very... All of these things that we're talking about, whether it's what he's saying on the song, what he's doing on the stage, what he's doing as far as his distribution strategy, I mean, this is all Prince saying the only motivations that matter are Prince's motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are fortunate to be witness to Prince's motivations and to sort of, like, imbibe from that well.
Yeah.
But, like, it's literally all about Prince and his choices in the moment.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, you know, seeing Prince live and seeing him with, like, different kinds of crowds, like a really enthusiastic crowd or a kind of crowd. And, like, Prince remains, like, very resolutely Prince regardless of the room, because what's taking place between him and his head and his guitar and the band, that's the entirety of it. I don't think he was a guy, like, I've talked to musicians sometimes who are like, well, you know, I'll work a tough room, you know, like, I try to, like, really da-da-da. I don't think Prince was ever like, wow, this is a tough room, I gotta win over. I think Prince was just like, well, y'all are lucky to see Prince for 3 hours, so I'm just gonna go ahead and be Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Has he ever had a tough room, though?
I was in a tough room.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was it hell? Where was that?
This is 2008 at the Gansevoort Hotel. He had just put out a book of photos from like a recent tour.
Mm.
I mean, I don't even want to say it was a stage. It was like a weird anteroom at the Gansevoort Hotel, and you could pay $1,000 for a ticket. I didn't pay $1,000. I went because John Perales did not. Was not able to go that night, so I covered it.
Sorry, I didn't go.
Yeah, no. But, and it was two sets, and the first set was, like, very clearly people who paid $1,000. And the second set was more fans. I mean, the balance was up. But the first set was just, like, a bunch of people who were just kind of rich people who would, like, were buying drinks and were kind of like, cool, I'm in this room with the Gansevoort Hotel and Prince is playing, as if they were entitled to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And Prince still just was, like, so Prince. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the fact that, like, of the 100-odd people in that room, maybe only a third were paying close attention.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just...
So you were in hell.
Yeah, galling.
Yeah.
Galling.
Yes.
If you were in that room with me...
Well, so picking up on John's list of, you know, binaries that you mentioned in your obit, that, you know, these, like, binaries that he transcended, you know, we're talking about... Man, woman, you know, I'm not a woman, I'm not a man, I'm something that you'll never understand. Sacred and profane, guitar hero and kind of like luscious soul ballad singer. Black, white, straight, gay, love, sex, the new way of doing things and the old way of
reverent
doing things.
And futuristic.
Yeah, control and generosity.
Also God and the devil.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not explicitly Satan, but there's a lot of like... You know, choices that can take you one direction or the other.
Yeah. There's something else I was thinking about, too, musically, yesterday as I was listening to WBLS. It was just great. It was like the station became Prince Radio. And I was thinking a reasonable amount of time it would take to do, like, Prince's good songs, 6 hours? I don't know. To even kind of scratch the surface, it would take a really long time.
Longer than that. Yeah.
Maybe longer than that. But every song I heard seemed to have something similar in it, which was that no matter whether the song was short or long, it could go on forever. Like, it could go on forever and be good.
Yep.
And all the nutrients that you want in a song are there. You know, the groove, the harmony, the moving harmony. It just seemed to be designed that way in endlessly repeatable units. And I thought, who else does this? I mean, like, this is a gospel thing. This is a philosophically a jazz thing. Like, you know, Paul Gonzalez doing endless choruses at Newport. But I don't know. In pop music?
This is trance music. This is ritual music. This is gospel. And this is, you know, African music. This is modular, repeatable, building the ecstasy. A song like Erotic City. Every time I think of that song, I hum it all day.
Mm-hmm.
It just sticks in your head and just goes and goes.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because Prince was so wedded to the stage. This is one of the great things about him was he could go in the studio by himself and be Stevie Wonder and make this song from the blueprint in his head. But he could also go on a stage and just whip a crowd into a frenzy and make that band work harder and harder and harder and just get everybody on their feet screaming.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that many stage people anymore because we're so studio bound. We're so music video, YouTube, do the 3 minutes, do the soundbite. Prince was an old time groove guy. He was James Brown and Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
And he was the Beatles.
But he was also like a mercenary. He's a killer at 3 minutes and 20 seconds. I mean, that's you can't lose sight of the fact that like the part of the reason we love these records is because they come at 3 minutes at a clip. You know, not that there aren't longer songs, but not to say that groove-oriented Prince is not peak Prince, because like when you see it in concert and you see what he does to those 3 minute songs in concert. But to your point, the idea that he has somehow found a formula or an approach where a song was like endlessly either compressible or expandable. Mm-hmm. And like literally any song that's on these records that is 3 minutes could be 6 minutes.
And there are 6 minute versions of a lot of these songs.
Right, oh, certainly. Right,
like 12 inches. Mm-hmm. Were, like,
yeah.
So control and generosity. I mean, like a song like Kiss is so skeletal.
Yeah.
And his vocals are so like halfway there, sort of, you know? And there's space in that song, and the solo is just short.
There's
and tight.
Two solos though in that song.
Aha!
You know what I mean? There's two different guitar solos in that record, and he's just like, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, Wendy worked it.
Yeah.
But he's also male and female in that song. I mean, he's also, you know, he's falsetto, but he's obviously putting the moves on somebody.
Yeah,
that song is. Typical Prince song. It's unifying all these things. He's above them. They're all in him.
Yeah.
He contains multitudes. And you can find that in any song of his, basically. I mean, you also think of the 3 minute killers, like When You Were Mine or Little Red Corvette. Mm-hmm. They're perfect little radio songs.
Yeah.
But then he could take them on stage and stretch them out.
Should we talk about experiences of seeing him and, you know, things that stayed with us? From those experiences? Do you want to start, John? I mean, you saw him.
I probably saw him more than you guys.
You saw him late 70s, early 80s in New York.
Yeah, I saw him before. I mean, Purple Rain, he was an icon after that. Purple Rain, you know, everybody came to worship Prince. I saw him in shows before that where he had to prove himself a little more. Mm. But he was incredibly athletic. He always had those bedroom eyes. He would always do something surprising. He would jam, but he had hit after hit. I remember thinking, you know, this is one of the greatest, this might be the greatest performer I will ever see.
Really?
That's what you would always think. Mm-hmm. Sure, especially if you were there in the room with him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who was better? Who was more musical, more athletic, more crazy, more concise? I mean,
nobody
who was
I
there?
Mm-hmm. More adaptable.
Do you remember specific performances?
I remember seeing him at Foxwoods or one, I think it was Foxwoods in 2013, at the end of 2013, for such a long time. He was one of those people where you just didn't know. I don't have a specific memory of that show. I just remember the duration because it's a casino. So when you leave, there are still people like casinoing. They were gone. I saw him, three times? I don't really remember what he did. I remember what I did.
Oh, yeah?
I danced.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The thing about him, and you want to watch him because he is a really great mover, obviously.
Mm.
But I remember just dancing. And he's the only, I mean, you know, I'll get up at some shows and I'll dance a little bit and then I'll sit down, or like I'll remain, if I'm standing the whole time, I'll move a little bit and then I'll stop. But I'm really interested in engagement with the performer, or like to see how they work. Prince is somebody I just felt like I didn't need to do that.
Yeah. You knew that he was taking care of himself.
Right.
He's going to be fine.
He wants me to enjoy myself.
Yes,
so
yes.
I am going to.
Sure.
Well, he wants to put you in your body in the moment.
Right. And
I'm
going
to listen to my body tonight.
I was fully in my body. I don't know what he did except make me dance for a long time.
But at one of the last shows I saw was a Meadowlands show,
yeah.
Where he's walking around on a giant glyph. There was a celebrity section, and he brought Kim Kardashian on stage to dance, and she had such high heels on that she couldn't move to save her life, and he kicked her off.
I remember that was
very,
yeah. That was
yes. Very widely circulated on the internet.
At the end of that show, you know, after the big band workout, after he's played every instrument on stage, after he's like worked his body to the bone, he walks to the edge of the stage. He's like making his exit. He walks off. He flips his hair back, and it goes dark.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect exit. Mm-hmm. Perfect spontaneous moment, but there was a light cue for it.
Sure.
And that's what you always saw with him. It was like, it was tightly rehearsed, but you never knew what he was going
to
do.
I was just going to bring up something very similar, a memory very similar to that. It was seeing him at the Garden, maybe 96, 97, the Maite years, and it was this unbelievable, you know, show of control. Like, I remember him saying something like, "Change those lights; they don't match my suit." And you know, as soon as he stuck his finger in the air, the light changed. And then there was another moment where Maite was brought out, and she did a very stylized belly dance.
Oh, Maite!
And he kind of framed himself around her, or provided a frame somehow for her, like, you know. And then at the end, he gave her a kiss. They're like, this was part of the music. I mean, this was totally part of the performance and part of his, like, fantastic control.
I mean, Prince was about delivery systems. Like, you know, Prince is like a guy who writes the song, produces the song, plays all the instruments on the song, arranges the song, and also gets it to you. In the exactly, he doesn't like, he wants you to dance, sure, but also it's like he wants you to dance because like it's his decision,
right? No, I was doing what he wanted,
yeah, like
to
it's
do.
His choice.
There was no, I'm not like, yo, yeah. I went and saw Prince, and guess what? I just danced. Yeah. No, I mean, I was following order,
yeah. Yes. Like, he probably had like a notepad, it's like, make Wesley Morris dance.
Right. What is it? I won't hurt you,
oh,
I only want you to have
some
fun,
yeah. Yep, yep.
Which is pretty much true. I mean, it was control, but you didn't have a feeling it was a power trip.
No.
It was sharing.
And, like, unlike the sort of stories you hear about James Brown or whatever, you know, being sort of like a very badly. Like, obviously, Prince in the 80s, you know, I mean, if you watch Purple Rain, you can see Prince being mad about various things. I definitely was watching it last night, and like that, the big slap scene, like, definitely caught me off guard.
The sock puppet moment.
I wasn't paying attention. I sort of like, oh my gosh. You know, for him, it really is vertical integration. It's like, if the idea starts here, he works it out, he plays it, and then it's like I'm gonna get it as close as humanly possible to here and to here. Mm. He's like, I want to control all those steps.
The idea might start a little lower, though.
Well, we're friends, but
you're an avowed fan of Prince's movies.
Yes,
correct.
I had a podcast that said so. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I actually find them really interesting. Like, none of them is good, but they're all fun, and there's a lot in them, and they do reframe Prince in this interesting way, right? Because he is not as a film performer. There's nothing there. But there's also something there. And you watch him in Purple Rain, and he is a magnetic presence. Mm. But it's Morris Day's movie. Morris Day is the star of Purple Rain. You don't leave that movie thinking anything else, except it's Prince's movie too. And when you leave that movie, the person you want to hang out with maybe is Morris Day, but the person you want to have sex with a lot is Prince. Mm-hmm. And that's a really powerful distinction that he couldn't quite harness for the other movies. In the other movies, he was remote, didn't have the swagger that he has in Purple Rain. Like Under the Cherry Moon, he seems completely confused about Kristin Scott Thomas's relationship to him. The conceit is really, it seems to me anyway, to be the reason that movie exists, like the black and white and, you know, the sort of the lushness of that Paris. A graffiti bridge, which is, you know, bad. Yeah. But I will say this about Graffiti Bridge. It is just a video. It is purely a vehicle for those songs. Mm-hmm. And those songs are good. Mm-hmm. They are mostly really good songs. Mm-hmm. I just realized the other day, last night, actually, I realized Elvis made like 31 movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine Prince making 31 movies? Like, I can't. Cause Elvis wasn't much better at being in the movies than Prince was.
Yeah.
But Elvis didn't direct his movies.
Well, that probably helped.
Yes.
And he did make 39 albums, Prince.
That's true. I mean, listen. I'm not asking for a trade-off or anything.
Yeah, I'd rather have the albums.
Yes, I would much rather have the albums than Prince and, like, Blue Hawaii. Thank you. You were correct.
One thing I retain from
Purple Hawaii.
From the last...
Purple Hawaii, sorry.
One thing I still think about from the last time I saw Prince in Baltimore. Last year?
Yeah, last year.
Was that, he's so precise and all that, but he was kind of relaxed. Mm-hmm. And he walked from one side of the stage to another. Like a dude from the 70s, you know, like
he had a strut,
complete like old school role, you know.
Yeah.
And I was thinking how much about Prince can be explained, you know, Prince is of no time, Prince is of his own time, whatever. But how much about Prince can be explained by the time that he did come out of, you know, when he first signed a record deal, he was adamant that he'd be signed on the pop side, not the R&B side. Like he was fighting straight out of the gate.
No, you know, because he demanded creative control at 19.
Right, right.
And got it.
Because of particular conditions in the music industry at that time. And that sort of helped set the stage for the path that he took.
In his later years when people started, you know, saying you're old school, he would say, you know, I'm from the organic era. I'm from the era when you play everything live. I'm from the James Brown and Stevie Wonder and George Clinton era.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in that he was Luddite, maybe, except that I would rather hear him play live than hear a computerized rhythm track.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't we all? I mean, I feel like, does that... Wait,
no,
that's,
I'm not...
No, I know what you're saying, but who's going to argue against you, is what I'm saying.
One of the great things about African-American music is there is ancestor worship. And you can see the through line, and the through line is important. You know, he would do his three-hour post-arena show club jams, they were every song he ever knew, and he knew every song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He would do P-Funk. He would do the Staple Singers. He would do whatever.
Right.
I mean, he wanted that continuity. He wasn't saying, I'm new. He was saying, I'm the culmination,
right,
which he was.
He also was, I mean, I think a lot of that stuff with Warner Brothers came directly from the old school, like the Aretha Franklins and the James Browns, like, pay me now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you pay me now, don't, I'm not messing with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, one thing that's in Therese's book was that he took a 3-semester music business class in high school.
Oh.
so he was like, I'm going to be a rock star. I better know this stuff.
Huh. Well, have we said our piece? Are we ever going to run out of things to say?
We will never run out of things to say.
Like Prince.
And I want to go in. I'm waiting for, I hope that the executors go into the vault. And
what's
find,
vaults?
Oh my God!
And,
yeah.
And find, you know, the next 39 albums, so we can have a Prince album a year forever.
Sure.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I thought parties weren't meant to last.
Well, this one has.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Party over. Oops, out of time.
And that's The Beautiful Ones by Prince. You can read our Prince coverage at nytimes.com. /music. Thanks to our producers, Pedro Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll see you next week.
The beautiful ones always smashed.